I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to The Connection.
Painting is born of nature. Or rather, it is the grandchild of nature. For all visible things are produced by nature. And these, her creations, have given birth to painting. So, we may justly call it the grandchild of nature and related to God.
That's Italian actor Adriano Giannini, the voice of Leonardo da Vinci, from the new PBS documentary about the famed artist. The two-part, four-hour series airs November 18th and 19th on WHYY and other PBS stations. It's directed by Ken Burns, his daughter Sarah Burns, and David McMahon. We're all familiar with Da Vinci's masterpieces, The Last Supper and the Mona Lisa, but he was so much more than a painter. His curiosity knew no bounds, as seen in the 6,000 notebook pages he filled with sketches, designs, diagrams, and observations revealing how he saw the world. On today's show, the mind of Leonardo da Vinci, what he has to tell us about creativity, and the connections between art and science, knowledge and imagination, and the natural world. Sarah Burns and David McMahon co-directed and wrote the film. They also directed and wrote and produced documentaries about the Central Park Five, Jackie Robinson, and Muhammad Ali. And they join us today on The Connection. Sarah Burns, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. And David McMahon, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty. Thrilled to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Jack Hinton. He's the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Henry P. McElhenney Curator of European Decorative Arts and Sculpture. And Jack, nice to have you with us on The Connection as well.
Thanks, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And Sarah, let me begin with you, but I want to also hear from you, David, which is so much of what you have done, and frankly, what Ken Burns has done, is to look at American figures, American history. You went all the way over to Italy to help us understand Leonardo da Vinci, which seems like such a shift for you in subject matter, time and place. Sarah, what drew you to Leonardo da Vinci?
Yeah, it absolutely is a very different kind of subject for us. As you said, not only non-American, the first time ever for my dad in you know, more than 40 years of filmmaking to do something not focused on the American experience, and also for us, something not in the 20th century, is really a big change. The idea first came from Walter Isaacson, who was then, back in 2017, working on his biography of Leonardo da Vinci. And he had dinner with my dad and pushed the idea of a Leonardo biography. He was then working on a Benjamin Franklin book, and Walter had also written a biography of Franklin. And he sort of saw them as connected in some way, that to do these simultaneously, exploring these geniuses from different centuries would be a nice pairing. And I think my dad's initial instinct was, no, we don't do non-American subjects. And he called us after the dinner and said, you know, Walter was kind of bugging me about this Leonardo idea. And I said, no way, we don't do that. And we said, why not? We could do that. Let's do Leonardo. I mean, what a fascinating, compelling character. And as soon as we started reading more about him, we were more and more convinced that this was a worthy subject to take on. And even if it was a little bit outside our normal area, it would be a joy to spend those years learning about Leonardo, which is any project. It's just a journey of discovery for us.
Absolutely. And I do want to get to all that. To you, David, what you don't have with Leonardo is any grainy footage from the 1930s. But you came up with, as you describe, a kind of new visual grammar to tell the story of Leonardo and his curious mind.
Yeah, it was a little daunting at first. We've really, our subjects have really allowed us to take advantage of the vast archives of footage there is in the 20th century, photographs of the subjects we've covered, and there's a total absence of that in this case. But we pretty quickly saw it as an opportunity. We immediately saw Leonardo as a lateral thinker who didn't make distinctions between art and science, and it opened up for us the possibility that we could do our own timeless cinematography of Italian landscapes. We could look closely at nature, and we could really luxuriate in all these incredible drawings and these notebook pages that he left behind, and use that to get in between Leonardo's ears. And so instead of doing a portrait that would feature the actual footage of our subject, we would try to go, in the way we do this very early in the film, we go plunging in through his eye into his brain,
Yeah.
and we're trying to see the world the way that he saw it. So the absence of that material was an opportunity.
You know, Sarah, I'm sure people listening to us say, well, I know about Leonardo da Vinci. I know The Last Supper. I know The Vitruvian Man. I know the Mona Lisa. What is Leonardo that we didn't know, that we don't know, that you wanted to explore?
There's so much, honestly, and I think we come in that way too, knowing a handful of paintings and maybe the idea that he was also a kind of engineer or scientist of some kind. But those notebooks that Dave was referring to are just this extraordinary way of looking at what he was thinking about, and that goes so deep. He pushed everything further and wanted to know more, and just has the most curious spirit. And so there's just it feels kind of bottomless. And there are experts who have spent lifetimes, careers, just trying to get a sense of what Leonardo was doing. And so that was really exciting for us to get to dive into that and go beyond the things that we all kind of know or think we know about Leonardo, but also to look at those things again, to say, how are we going to tell the story of the Mona Lisa and help people understand this most famous painting on earth in maybe a new way, in a way that brings in the context of all of Leonardo's life, all of his scientific research, and see how that informs this one painting. And so that was part of the process, was always about just trying to dig deeper. I think one of our experts very early on said that what we needed to try to do was rip the beard off of Leonardo, because we only ever see him as this kind of wizard-like figure with a long beard. Any of the paintings or portraits of him depict him that way, as this kind of old man sage. And of course, that's not his whole life, and that's not his whole way of understanding him. And so we always want to get at that, this a complicated person, as everyone is in three dimensions. He was a young person, he was a child. What was his life like? What was his personality like? And how can we get inside his head?
And to you, Jack, to pull you into the conversation here, what do you see as, almost afraid to ask this question because it seems so basic, but his uniqueness as an artist? I mean, what we hear from both Sarah and David is his ability to make sort of connections in the world, but how do you see him?
Well, for me, it's really about his curiosity, this sense of insatiable curiosity that you see so much in his drawings. This idea of not resting, really, of constantly wanting to figure out ideas on the page to keep going, as Sarah says, to keep kind of diving in, pushing things further, which, I mean, really speaks to his great richness, and then also his artistic ambition of wanting to do more, to push technique in a way. And what we also see is that sometimes, honestly, he failed. He pushed things too far and it didn't work out. But that sense of drive, of really wanting to experiment and go further.
And to you, David, what I sense from the film is just his restlessness. I mean, he started many paintings, but he didn't finish a lot of them. You can see in his drawings, he's just constantly looking at to understand the world, but a kind of restlessness, it seemed to drive him.
Yeah, there's an incredible seeking that's going on always. And then there's also a profound amount of imagination. I think that he's learning from the ancients and he's reading the collected works of all the scholars of his day, and he's trying to understand through book learning, but he's also very much out having experiences and observing the world, and he's pouring all of this into his work. And so I think often the work should be seen as, whether it's a painting or something in science or a mechanical innovation, as a kind of experiment, as a kind of exploring. And so if he doesn't finish a painting, it's perhaps because he found out what he was hoping to find out in doing that painting. So maybe it's something about atmospheric perspective. Maybe it's something about why the sky is a certain shade of blue at a certain altitude and another shade of blue at a lower altitude. And so maybe he leaves a painting after he's figured out everything that he has wanted to discover. At the same time, when he doesn't finish, you end up being able to look at the painting and see how it is it was coming together for him. And what you learn is that in his day and age, artists may have used a cartoon as a blueprint, and they would have done all their thinking about what the painting was before they hit the panel. He's experimenting with what he wants the painting to be on the panel. And we can see that because he doesn't finish some of his works. And so this is a new way of approaching painting that we're able to actually see because he didn't finish. And so that's to our benefit. And so I wouldn't always think of the unfinished works as him moving on to something else because he got bored or interested in something else, as much as perhaps that he had found out what he was seeking and was ready to move on to something else.
Sarah, let me put this to you. He was born out of wedlock. I don't know how unusual it was at that time, but he didn't have a kind of formal education, I guess, that others of his station, as he sort of moved into it, had at that time. How do you think that influenced him as an artist?
I think it had a huge influence on him. I think if he had been born to his father within a marriage, his father was a prominent notary who traveled between Vinci and Florence, he would have probably been expected to become a notary, as was the kind of family tradition. And he would have had this kind of more classical education, learning Latin and studying the ancients. And he did those things on his own later. But as a result of the fact that he did not get this classical education, traditional education, he grew up in nature, in the country, with nature as his first and greatest teacher. And he became self-taught. So he ultimately read all of these things. He, as a probably around the age of 40, tried to teach himself Latin. You see him writing these lists of words in Latin in his notebooks. But I think he had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder about it, that he sort of saw himself as different from these scholars. He very much wanted to be seen as an intellectual, but he also felt like these people who learned everything from books were missing something really important, and that he learned not just by reading those books, but through observation and experiment and exploring the world around him. And he both was sort of proud of that. He was a little bit annoyed that those people might think less of him because he didn't have that education, but he thought he was better than them because he read those books, but he also did his own thinking and his own questioning of those ideas. He was not just receiving that wisdom from the books and accepting it. He was saying, yes, but I want to know more, and I want to see if this is really true for myself, and I'm going to go out and figure that out myself.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation with Sarah Burns and David McMahon. They co-directed and co-wrote the new documentary about Leonardo da Vinci, along with Ken Burns. Jack Hinton from the Philadelphia Museum of Art is with us as well. We'll be talking much more about the artist, his creativity, and all the connections he was making in his world. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia, and we're talking about a new two-part, four-hour series that will air Monday and Tuesday, November 18th and 19th on WHYY and other PBS stations. It's about Leonardo da Vinci, directed by Ken Burns, his daughter Sarah Burns, and David McMahon. Sarah Burns and David McMahon join us today on the show, along with Jack Hinton, who's a curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Jack, let me go back to you, and let's put Leonardo into a bit of context. Italy, the second half of the 15th century. This is the Renaissance, an explosion of creativity and other things. Sort of create a world around this artist that we've been talking about.
Sure. I mean, when he comes to Florence in the 1470s, you know, to work in the studio of Andrea del Verrocchio, who's a great sculptor and painter, and really is also an artist who's an experimenter. So in a way, you can imagine that Leonardo, as well as learning from nature, learned a lot from Verrocchio, from his master, and also from his fellow apprentices in the workshop. And Verrocchio, you know, wasn't satisfied to only work in one area. I mean, he made the this globe on the cupola of the Duomo. He made sculptures, and he made paintings and many other things. This sense of experimentation there, I think, was powerful. But Florence itself in the 15th century was a republic, but really an oligarchy, you know, run by its most wealthiest residents, who were rich from banking and textiles and other trades, especially the Medici family. So they really supported artists through patronage, and the other wealthy families there, I suppose their other supporters did too. And so that really created or fostered an environment where artists were, you know, able to be ambitious, to make public works, to have kind of public success. And it really fostered, I think, this sense of wanting to kind of praise or recognize ingenuity. I mean, I think there's this moment where there's this great sense of possibility for artists working in the city in this period. And so you can imagine Leonardo coming into that and then, you know, really seeing or being perhaps sort of moved by the success of his fellows in the same kind of directions. And obviously his genius kicks in there and allows him to go further, or actually to go to Milan, you know, where he then works for Ludovico Sforza.
Yeah, and the story goes on. David, what we also learned from the documentary, and this is other people talking about Leonardo, is that he was a lot of fun. I really like that part of him. You know, someone that you might want to hang out with and talk with and have a cup of coffee with.
Yeah, certainly. You know, he comes up, as Jack was saying, in Andrea del Verrocchio's bottega, and I kind of imagine this as a space that's maybe not unlike, you know, Andy Warhol's factory of the mid-20th century. Right. These are young people who are working really hard. They're exploring different crafts. They're learning sculpture. They're learning painting. They're learning math. They're learning poetry. And I could only imagine that it was a great time. And although the historical record is pretty thin on Leonardo's life, he doesn't leave a lot of notes about what his life was like. He's not a diarist. He's very focused on his work. That's what takes up the notebooks. The contents of the notebooks are about his work. But people who did spend time with him, in the limited number of references we have from that period, suggest that he was a really fun guy. He was a great dresser. He had jokes. He was a musician. He could really entertain. He would have been great on Ludovico Sforza's court. And so from what little we've glimpsed through these accounts, we understand that he would have been a lot of fun to be around.
He was also, Sarah, he was also gay. And again, in this film, we learn that at that time, it was really, if you were gay, it was a crime that was punishable by death. It was condemned by the church. And yet, you know, either he was tolerated or the powers that be looked the other way. Is there a way that we can understand his homosexuality and its effect on him as an artist?
You know, it's hard to say in terms of its effect on him as an artist, but certainly there is this seeming kind of contradiction in that, yes, it was frowned upon by the church and potentially something that was punishable by death. But the reality was that in Florence in that period, there was a relative openness and acceptance to people who were gay, not just Leonardo, other artists and poets. And there were people who were kind of openly gay, and that was not a huge problem. And so it feels a little bit like a contradiction, but I think that that was the reality in Florence at the time, was that there was a certain kind of openness. And so I don't think it's something that people were that careful to hide in that sense. But at the same time, there was an incident when Leonardo was a young man where he was probably actually arrested based on this kind of anonymous accusation of him against him and several other people. And so he might have, you know, spent a night or a few nights in a prison cell. And, you know, ultimately those charges were dropped. Someone else who was accused was part of a prominent family, which may be why that happened. But, you know, that might have been a scary experience, I would imagine. And so he didn't write about it or talk about it at all. Not that experience, not his sexuality. And so, you know, you wonder whether that was protective. you know, keeping that kind of private. But also, as Dave pointed out, he didn't generally write about his personal life.
Right.
He wrote these thousands and thousands of pages, but it was his intellectual life that he put on paper, not his feelings about things.
We've touched on this, but David, I want to just dig a little bit deeper about his ability to make connections between elements in the natural world, between art and science, between experience and observation, between light and shadow that we see in his paintings. This ability to see how things are related to each other seems to be part of his genius.
Yeah, you know, I think he imagined himself as a second nature, which is to say that he wanted to learn all the rules of nature and then see how he could apply them to whatever it is that he's working on. And so if he's studying the human body, he could make a gorgeous drawing of a fetus and it becomes a great work of art. And if he's doing machinery, you could see his own mastery of light and shadow and the drawing of some sort of innovation that he is creating. And so, you know, in the film, we wanted to put those things side by side. We wanted to see the snail shell and the spiral in it that he was looking at, and then see how that shows up in his drawings or in a curl of hair, and then we could begin to feel how the lines between these things are blurred. And so these explorations were central to his understanding of the world, and then they're repeated in the creations that he makes.
Well, let me play another clip from the film. And again, this is the Italian actor Adriano Giannini, who is the voice of Leonardo da Vinci. And here he is talking about the earth and the body and the connections there.
The earth has a living soul, and its flesh is the soil. Its bones are the strata and structures of the rocks which form the mountains. Its blood is its veins of water. The pool of blood around the heart is the ocean. Its breathing, by the rise and fall of blood through the pulses, is likewise in the earth, the ebb and flow of the sea.
I mean, that's really beautiful. I think it even works on the radio. Jack, do you want to weigh in on that? I mean, this connection between, you know, the blood flowing through our veins and the rivers and the oceans.
Well, I mean, artists certainly in this period, you know, studied nature and studied nature very, yeah, very carefully. And yeah, so I think it really speaks to Leonardo's level of investment or interest, I suppose, in that and how it influences work. I enjoyed particularly in the documentary, how David and Sarah show his scientific drawings and show really, you know, his ability to imagine in different ways to show anatomy, you know, different approaches to show the body that hadn't existed before. And so that really speaks to this ability to not only draw, but then also to innovate in terms of how the information is presented. And again, it makes him so special.
Yeah. And David, he would, you know, he dissected bodies, he dissected skulls to literally see how this works, how we work as human beings, right?
Yeah, he didn't want to stop at the surface. And as what's interesting is, Sarah alluded to this earlier, is that when he does these dissections and he does these drawings, and then as he's preparing a treatise that would explain human anatomy and physiology and his discovery, you can detect a kind of arrogance in there. You know, I can withstand the horrible smells of dissecting a body so that I could see what's happening in there and then draw it in a way that you could then learn from and then apply to your own work. But I think also what's important to understand about his study of anatomy and physiology is that the people of his times, as Jack said, the artists of their time would have been studying anatomy and physiology so they could apply it to their paintings. But the wisdom that they were using that came to them in book form would have been from the ancients. It would have been 18 centuries old. That would have just been accepted and never challenged. And the drawings kind of reflect that too. They're quite simple and there's not a lot of wisdom or real understanding of the human body in them. And so when you see the leap from his drawings, which are their art, their really deep understanding of anatomy and physiology, from what came before, it's really profound. And these are drawings that still make sense to people studying medicine today. And they have an incredible beauty to them. They're really works of art. And so it's just in him, he's doing things that people are doing at his time, but he's taking it so much deeper. It's really reflected in his study of anatomy and physiology, maybe more so than anywhere else.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the three of you. That's David McMahon, who joins us along with Sarah Burns, who produced, wrote, and directed, along with Ken Burns, this new documentary about Leonardo da Vinci. And again, it will air on PBS stations on November 18th and 19th, including here on WHYY. And Jack Hinton is with us as well. He is a curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Let me play another clip from the film. And this is Leonardo talking about birds and machines.
The bird is a machine that functions according to mathematical law. Man has the capacity to create this machine and all its motions, but without as much power. Such a machine lacks nothing except the bird's soul, which must be counterfeited by man.
And Sarah, if I can go back to you, he seemed to be obsessed with birds and flight. We see drawing after drawing after drawing of him trying to understand how flight works.
Yeah, it's a focus of his really across his life, this fascination with flight, with the flight of birds and with this idea of the possibility of human flight. And he designs these human flying contraptions, different ways of trying to get a person up in the air. It's unclear that I don't think he ever actually built them. And certainly if he did, they wouldn't have worked. The materials that he had access to in his time would have been too heavy. You know, they wouldn't quite have worked, but the ideas behind them are really brilliant. And it's because of the way he was studying nature. He was not just saying, oh, it would be cool to fly. He was saying, how do birds fly? How do dragonflies fly? What are the mechanisms of this process? And he moves on a little bit. He always has this kind of dream of flying, this imagination of it. And of course, he's right. We eventually do fly.
That's right.
But he studies birds so carefully. And some of the things that he is understanding about aerodynamics and about lift and the forces around, you know, how birds, what's called dynamic soaring, how they sort of use gravity and wind currents to kind of help them fly and soar, is way ahead of his time. And it's amazing the way he's combining this imagination, this creativity, this idea, maybe we could fly someday, with this very accurate, practical observation of nature that is really trying to understand how that's actually possible. So even if he doesn't quite put that together, he is exactly right in the way that he's looking at these things and trying to understand, you know, if I design this structure using a bat as a model, if I look at the way birds do, you know, soar in this way, maybe I can figure this out. And, you know, eventually someone, you know, it's 450 years before someone actually creates a human powered flying machine. Does happen.
And it does. Indeed, it does. Jack, let me make a huge leap from birds and flying machines to The Last Supper. It's half an hour and we haven't really talked about The Last Supper, but nonetheless. And there were obviously other Last Suppers at this time and in previous times as well. What does he bring to this drama that perhaps other artists do not?
Well, again, I think perhaps it's about ambition. There were other Last Suppers, I mean, by his contemporaries, by Castagno and others, that he would have been aware of in Florence, you know, before making his in Milan. But what he brings to it, I think, is this sense of sort of simultaneity of the emotional kind of roiling of the scene, of the reactions of the apostles to what Christ is telling them. You know, one of them will betray him. And, you know, it's sort of episodic. I mean, it's meant to be read as a totality, but it's really about seeing the kinds of reactions sort of play out in that moment. And I think, you know, once it was completed and it was acknowledged as being a great, great masterpiece, and it has this great influence afterwards. So it's about again, that kind of ambition, I think, again, of going beyond.
Well, and David, I think one of the people that you interview for the film talks about it as a kind of film, that there's something very psychological. I mean, we know what's going on in The Last Supper, but somehow it gets beyond the kind of static representation into something more psychological in a way.
Yeah, I think he's clear. Like, it's very ambitious, as Jack said, and he's electrified by the story, and he's doing the things that he's commissioned to do in this painting. But it does seem to tie in, say, his study of anatomy and physiology. He wants to know how the body could be a kind of responsive machine to a bit of information, and what a piece of information this is. Yeah. These are 13 disciples who would have followed Christ over the cliff, and here he is telling them that one of them is going to betray him, and that will lead to his death. And so what Leonardo has sort of constructed using geometry, using anatomy and physiology, is the moment and that they react to this. And so all their reactions are very different. One is clutching a knife. One is, you know, pulling his head back in surprise. And you can see the veins of Judas's neck popping out. He's sort of curious about how they all would have had different reactions to this profound piece of information. And so it sort of led me to feel as if maybe he would have been a filmmaker had he lived today. He's interested in the human reaction to this news.
Sarah, we're almost up in our second break here, but you and David lived in Florence, a place where Leonardo lived, among other places as well. What was it about being there that helped inform this documentary, this film?
Yeah, it was really important, I think, for us. We did a lot of the research and some of the writing while we were there. We did a lot of filming while we were there of the Italian landscapes, but also in Florence and other cities. We filmed workshops in Florence where they are still today doing some of the same kinds of craft work, and in some cases even with the same kinds of tools and methods as they did during the Renaissance. And so it just allowed us to immerse ourselves in this place that, while it's very different 500 years later, in many ways it's the same. And there are things that really you can feel like you are walking in Leonardo's footsteps in these areas of town. You go, that's where Verrocchio's Bottega was in this neighborhood, and here's a street named after him. And it just to feel like we were immersing ourselves in that space, in the language. It was important to us from the beginning that we present Leonardo as Italian. I mean, it wasn't a unified country at that time, but, you know, he speaks this language, a version of modern Italian that we have today related to it. And we wanted to make sure that our audiences were always aware of that. It's why we cast an Italian actor as our voice of Leonardo. It's why some of our interview subjects we interviewed in Italian and in French, just for the, I mean, it's, these are beautiful languages and it's wonderful to hear them, but also to just have this reminder of where we are and what this language is and what he was hearing and experiencing.
And I got to jump in because we have to take another short break. We'll be right back talking about Leonardo da Vinci. Stay with us.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm Marty Moscowen, and we're talking about Leonardo da Vinci, the subject of a new PBS documentary that will air on Monday and Tuesday, November 18th and 19th. It's a two-part, four-hour series. Obviously, you can watch it on WHYY and other PBS stations. It's directed by Ken Burns, Sarah Burns, and David McMahon. Sarah Burns and David McMahon join us today on The Connection, along with Jack Hinton, who is a curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Jack, let me go back to you. We've been obviously focusing on Leonardo for all the obvious reasons, but also working and painting at this time was Michelangelo. How did they view each other? How were they competitive with each other? How do you think they worked off each other, if they did?
I don't get the impression that they were terribly friendly, no.
Okay.
They were put together, not, I think, necessarily voluntarily, by the, I suppose, leaders of Florence in the early 16th century with two rival fresco paintings in the Plaza della Signoria. And, you know, Michelangelo was making the Battle of Cascina, and then Leonardo was doing the Anghiari, this other famous battle scene that neither of them finished, but that become important to artists subsequently from seeing, you know, what remained or the drawings, you know, the very influential works. But I don't think they got along particularly, no. And Michelangelo was famously prickly and not, I suppose, like Leonardo, this rather fun, outgoing kind of character.
David, let me go back to you, and you have talked about, and the film talks about the fact that when it came to paintings, you know, he started, but he didn't finish all of them. And I wonder, do we know how his patrons felt about asking for something, but then the artist does not deliver the painting?
Well, it's interesting. He does seem to complete the paintings when he's working for a tyrannical duke, who's a Duke Sforza. And so we get a completed Last Supper, although that painting began to fall off the wall in his lifetime, or a portrait of one of the duke's mistresses. But I think the church was often commissioning him works and he wasn't finishing them, but they kept coming back. I think you mentioned Michelangelo earlier. Like, these are the first in a class of superstar artists who people can't get enough of them, and they want to feature their works in their spaces. And so we are coming from a period of bottegas where our artists are artisans, and they're being hired to make crafts that can be displayed in the palazzos of the wealthy merchants that Jack spoke about before. But now suddenly it's Michelangelo and it's Leonardo, and this kind of just grows. And so it is an era where you get, as Adam Gopnik describes in the film, the painters become kind of princes of the mind. And from that point on, we want to talk about them as one name individuals, and the value of their work goes up and up and gets collected. And so I think there's a big transformation that's taking place in that moment.
One name meaning Leonardo or Michelangelo, sort of,
yes,
like Cher, in the Cher today.
Yeah, it's how we remember them. I mean, I couldn't give you Leonardo's full name, but there are many parts to it. Da Vinci, of course, is referencing where it is that he comes from. And, you know, Michelangelo needs no further introduction.
Indeed. Sarah, let me go back to you. And later in life, Leonardo seems to find the perfect patron. This is Francis I of France, invites Leonardo to live near him, sets him up in a beautiful castle, and basically says, do your thing. You don't have to do anything for me. Help us understand what that meant to Leonardo and what he produced in this time of his life.
Yeah, I think he was always looking for that he, because he had all of these varied interests, you know, he was famous in his time as a painter, but I mean, he wanted to do all of these other things, these scientific experiments. I think the paintings to him were scientific experiments. And so over the years, as we've talked about, all of these patrons who demanded that he finish things, he didn't finish things. It was always a little complicated. He needed to eat. He needed someone to pay him to do this work, but he also wanted to be able to do all the things he wanted to do and investigate and push further and explore his curiosities. And with Francis, he finally gets that. I think Francis wanted, he was young, you know, he was 21 years old and newly the king and very well educated. And what he wanted was this kind of wise master who could teach him. And he believed that Leonardo, as a sculptor who knew them, said that the king thought there was no one in this world who knew as much as Leonardo. And so Francis, François Premier, saw Leonardo as this Aristotle to his Alexander, and he wanted him there to teach him, to learn from him. And so he gave him a stipend and set him up in this beautiful house and basically said, you can do what you want. I'm not going to demand that you finish this painting for me. So Leonardo was finally allowed to just tinker, and he continued working on some of these paintings that he'd, some of which were commissions that he'd had for now 15 years that he didn't deliver, and he just continued to work on, like the Mona Lisa, but also just to do geometrical problems and to do experiments, even as he's beginning to age and his body is maybe not letting him do as much as he once did.
And the Mona Lisa, Jack, I mean, maybe the most famous painting in the world, you know, I don't know if that's actually true or not, but nonetheless, a painting that he carried around with him for a number of years and then finished when he was living in France. you know, we all think we know the Mona Lisa, have looked at it. What does he bring to this painting that sets it apart?
It's hard to dissect something so iconic. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we would all agree that it's the most famous painting in the world. It's interesting. I mean, he is bringing. You can see that there are lessons still in this painting where, you know, he was looking at the work of Verrocchio, his master's work, where he makes bust length sculptures with the hands. There's another painting by Leonardo in Washington of Ginevra da Benci, which was similarly composed at one point, would have had her hands in it, but it was cut down. So, you know, he was sort of experimenting with this kind of half-length style of portrait, which then has the landscape in the background. But that's also coming from Flemish painting, from Northern painting, which is inspiring Italian artists in the 15th century. But, of course, you know, again, it's about going beyond that to create something deeper, more powerful, more meaningful, and it's in a way it's almost a bit disappointing to see the picture in real life because it's quite small and there are usually 15 million people in front of you
with their
trying to get there. But you know, again, the thing that's enjoyable, I think, for viewers of the documentary is that you do get to see it up close and you can see then this sort of treatment of the flesh, this sort of sense of the kind of the inner life, the inner workings of the Mona Lisa, and you know what's going on in her mind. Or this important thing that Leonardo said was the duty of the artist to try and represent. It's all there. So to see it as a kind of culmination, you know, of everything he'd worked towards or thought about, you know, as a logical way to see it.
And to you, David, I mean, this is a very modern word, but psychological. I mean, it feels as if there's a intense kind of psychology at work in the Mona Lisa, and we feel like there's a living person, a living, breathing person there.
Yeah, certainly. As Jack said, we're trying to see the motions of the mind in the Mona Lisa, and it for us sort of became a culmination of his life's work. We wanted to, across the 4 hours, sort of land at the Mona Lisa, and I think we were in part permitted to do that because he does carry it across the Alps from Milan to France, where he's going to spend his final days, and he does get a visit from a cardinal who has an associate who pens a little recollection from the day saying that Leonardo had these paintings, including the Mona Lisa. And so it's sort of a last thing that we can land on. And what it does is give us a chance to see how he's funneled all his understanding of nature and all his work on the human body, on anatomy, on physiology, on psychology, into this one painting to make something that is representative of all that he was trying to understand about the world in his time here.
Sarah, you commissioned Caroline Shaw to do music for this documentary series, Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, Grammy-winning composer. We've been playing some music from her compositions performed by the Attica Quartet, Room Full of Teeth, So Percussion, and John Patitucci. It is wordless, which, frankly, I appreciate. Tell us what you were going for, what you wanted in terms of what the music would bring to this story.
Yeah, I think from the very beginning, and this is unusual for us to do a fully original score in this way. Most of our films, we would use period music from the time that helps kind of place you in the moment. With Muhammad Ali, we used, you know, over 150 original songs from the time that Muhammad Ali lived. In this case, we didn't want to just use Renaissance music and record things that would have been, you know, instruments of the time and the kinds of music of the time, because I think we felt that Leonardo, while he's very much a man of his time, he is also feels very modern. That imagination, that curiosity, the way that he is kind of foreseeing in some ways these innovations of the future, and the way he's thinking about all of these things just make him so modern. And we wanted the music to reflect that and to give kind of bring him to life in a way, to create this kind of humanity of Leonardo. And we could not be more lucky that we were able to get Caroline Shaw to do that, because her music is filled with joy. And in that way, I think beautifully represents Leonardo's spirit, that kind of seeking and awe that he had in the world around him and in nature is there in Caroline's music. And she really understood, I think, how to create these sounds. And, you know, we originally, in talking about it, imagined that strings and percussion would be a good kind of way to create a soundtrack. And Caroline then also suggested using this vocal group of which she is a member called Roomful of Teeth.
Yeah,
and
great.
We wondered about that, whether that would fit in or sort of compete with the narration and the other audio in the film. But they don't, as you said, there's no lyrics to these songs. It's vocalizations. And it just fits so beautifully and gives this kind of human character to the soundtrack that just lifts the whole thing up, I think. And we're so thrilled with how that turned out.
Yeah, I think it's actually very beautiful and it works throughout the film. Jack, do you see Leonardo as, if not modern, that he has something to tell us, the modern world?
Sure. I mean, stay curious. And stay, I suppose, curious. Engage your sense of wonder, right, at all times. That's something I think that can carry us forward or give us hope.
Yeah. Do you see it that way as well, David?
Yeah, I do, for sure. I also find in him a kind of joy in toiling. And, you know, it's being out there, it's observing, it's observing longer, trying to take more time to make sense of things, and then coming back into the studio and getting it down, and then tinkering further. And in those notebooks, which are really the best way to understand him, there's not a lot, as we've been talking about, of how he's feeling about things, but you can sort of detect between the lines a kind of joy in the work that he's doing, and a kind of ecstasy that he's experiencing in the discoveries he's making. That really stood out for me.
I wonder too, David, and I'd be curious from you, Sarah, as well, whether there's some kind of connection or through line between Leonardo da Vinci and the men who are the Central Park Five, Jackie Robinson, Muhammad Ali. David, I'll put that to you first. Do you see how Leonardo fits into your exploration of people so far?
Well, I'm not sure how much of a connection I would make between their worldviews. I think what it did, it forced our focus on a more kind of an interior sense of Leonardo. I mean, his flaws are not as visible in the way that some of the characters that we've studied more recently. I think because it's harder to see him and he remains mysterious, it just permitted us to focus on what he was thinking and what he was working on and look for truths that were more about that than they were about emotion. I mean, making connections between the experiences of some of our other subjects is easier because the emotional layers are more apparent. And with Leonardo, that's not true. And so maybe we get a more ecstatic truth about him. But we're taking the same approach, which is to say that our allegiance was going to be to the facts of his life. There are just so many fewer of them, which allowed us to wander off the path a little bit and think more about what he might have been experiencing out in the world, and maybe bring that back to our viewers by splitting the screen and hitting them with a particular soundtrack that is not like the ones we've used in the past, as Sarah described. But just, it opened up a lot of doors that did not present themselves, I think, on previous projects.
And I'm looking at the clock here. Sarah, let me toss this to you. You and David are married to each other. You work on projects together. How do you make that work?
Well, we've been doing it now for 15 years.
Yeah, and so apparently I think it's working, right?
It's working, yeah. I mean, when we first sat down to begin working on the Central Park 5 film, we had to write a sort of treatment, a very brief treatment for it. And normally when we write, we don't write sort of together at the computer. You know, we write at our own computers a few feet away from each other and then kind of compare notes. But in that case, we actually we were working on this thing together. It was kind of the first thing we did. And we thought, if we can survive this, you know, sitting in front of one computer and staring at a blank screen and do that together, then maybe this will work. And it did. And it now has for 15 years. So it's pretty fun.
And from your perspective, David?
Oh, I couldn't be happier. Sarah is a patient and thoughtful collaborator. Maybe I run a little hot sometimes, and she always leads us in the right direction. So it's been. I wouldn't have imagined that we would have worked together when we first met. But you know, she wrote this book about the Central Park Five,
right.
And she had such a fierce determination to tell their story, and I think with her dad, who I had been working with for years, it sort of felt like, we wanted to follow her lead, and you know, she had made contacts with the five, and she had earned their trust, and it felt like a story that really needed to be told. And so, it's sort of gone from there.
Well, I really appreciate what you've done with all your documentaries and this one as well on Leonardo da Vinci. Sarah Burns, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And David McMahon, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Jack Hinton, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure.
And I should add that the documentary, the PBS documentary, co-directed by our guests, Sarah Burns and David McMahon, will air on Monday and Tuesday, November 18th and 19th on PBS stations, including WHYY. Go to whyy.org/theconnection to find out much more about the program. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.